If you take all your fears about modern technology, smartphones, social media, privacy, vulnerability, and multiply them by 100 or so, you're ready for the two novels we'll explore today. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Alyssa Nutting's novel, Made for Love, looks like a romance novel, but open the cover and you're plunged into a world where there's no such thing as privacy. Even her main character's innermost thoughts can be accessed by her estranged husband. Benjamin Percy's novel, The Dark Net, takes primal, ancient fears and mixes them with new high-tech fears, making for a truly terrifying combination. I'll talk with both authors this hour. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we'll explore two novels that explore the dark side of the information age. Benjamin Percy's latest, The Dark Net, mixes old-fashioned horror, high-tech monstrosities, and current events to terrify his readers. I'll talk with him in a few minutes. We're going to start with a very different novel that treads in some similar territory with some high-tech terror. Alyssa Nutting is here. She's an associate professor of English at Grinnell College. Her second novel, Made for Love, is a book that you cannot judge by its cover. It looks like a romance novel, but it's dark, smart, scary, and funny. It also just received a rave review in the New York Times Book Review. Alyssa, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And I have to say that when I started reading the book, I had very few expectations going in other than looking at this cover, which there's a beach scene, there are dolphins off in the distance. We learn more about why they're there later. But were you in any way trying to trick your readers into picking this up?
My editor told me that for the cover, they had found this airbrush T-shirt artist in Florida. And my first thought was make sure that we get two red solo cups right in there. Like I just wanted the excitement of the red solo cup, airbrush T-shirt. but then I immediately had this sort of, panic attack of is it going to read ironic, right, or genuine? And yes, I mean, I think that it does walk that tightrope, definitely. But there is a little something delightful and sad both about airbrush T-shirts, if only just because, they can't last, so there is sort of this, inherent tragedy that I hope translates also.
The main character in your book is Hazel, and she's a woman who is in a crisis in her life. Marriage is ending. It's a lot more complicated than that. But as we get to know her, maybe you could start off by reading a little bit so we get to know. It's a little bit of her backstory, a little bit of Hazel as she was growing up. But I think it gives us a real feel for who this woman is.
Sure. She began remembering how often she'd wanted to scream when lining up for the bus at elementary school because everything felt so artificial. No one was okay, but it was not okay to say that. There they were, ages 5 to 10, most of them in brightly colored clothing with cartoon backpacks that seemed designed for a utopia in an almost mean way. They were all emotional messes, especially Hazel. By the age of 9, Hazel sometimes had a fantasy daydream at school where the teacher walked into the classroom and yelled, "Isn't everything horrible? Doesn't the pain of the world outweigh the joy by trillions? Would you like to push all of the desks into the center of the room and burn them in a giant bonfire? Then we can run around screaming and weeping amidst the smoke in a truthful parade of our human condition. Since you are small-statured, children, it might help others to feel the full brunt of your agitation if you wave sticks and shrubbery over your heads all the while. We don't want to kill anything. We don't have to kill. Everything living that we've ever seen or known will die without our intervention, ourselves included. This is a psychological lead blanket that even our most pervasive moments of comfort cannot crawl out from under, and one unextinguishable source of despair, so we won't be performing any ritualistic sacrifices. That's not the direction we will go in just yet. However, Assistant Principal Lawrence is on the prowl for a road carcass we might be able to use as a representative prop, because nowhere in our autumn-themed poster board decor is morbidity or decay symbolized. Our school board members cannot agree on how best to acknowledge the boundlessness of human cruelty. In our society, some of you are far safer and more advantaged than others. At home, some of you are far more loved. Some of you will find that concepts like fairness and justice will be thin, flickering holograms on the periphery of your lives. Oh, look, children, I see Mr. Lawrence in the distance dragging a portion of a highway slaughtered deer. Let's go help him lug it inside and be reminded that we, too, inhabit bodies made of meat-wrapped bones. Let's meditate on this corporeal terror. Whenever her mother had asked, Hazel always told her, "School is great."
That's Alyssa Nutting reading from her novel, Made for Love. So that introduces us to Hazel. It's safe to say she's not a happy woman. She didn't have a happy childhood.
Correct.
And things are pretty dark inside Hazel's mind and life. But there's the story begins as she's leaving her marriage. And we flash back to the beginning of the relationship that led to her marriage. And that meeting is really reminiscent of a recent novel that sold a lot of books, which was 50 Shades of Grey.
Correct.
So Hazel is this college student. She meets with a tech billionaire, and he is very taken with her and wants to start a relationship with her. That had to be intentional.
Yeah, I mean, that book was just everywhere, you know, I read sections of it, and I'm just thinking, you know, if you are kind of this nobody, right, that this, you know, billionaire plucks, right, for marriage, he's not just going to want to, like, give you endless orgasms all day, right? It's going to come with a really heavy price. He is going to want things from you that probably, right, are going to challenge and compromise your sense of self.
Yeah, and 50 Shades of Grey turns into something of a fairy tale. This is not a fairy tale. So
that's a safe description. Right? Yeah, not a fairy tale.
But I found myself thinking that this was a much more accurate description of a relationship with a balance of power that is so out of whack because her husband, Byron, holds all the power. Tell us a little bit about him.
He's like a really, really, really evil sort of Steve Jobs-ish character. So he has founded this corporation, Google, that is kind of in charge of all of the devices that people are on and use most. And his kind of next big idea, the next thing he wants to launch, is a meld, essentially. He wants to place a microchip in Hazel's brain and use their sort of love and their relationship to help sell this this new technology to the public. And so it would mean that he would have access to all of her thoughts at all times, but she would not have access to his. It would be a one-way gate.
Where this relationship is, obviously, there's science fiction involved, or at least it's still science fiction today, maybe not tomorrow.
Right.
But it also really followed sort of the textbook example of an abusive relationship. Was that your goal?
Yeah, I mean, I think that so often, you know, relationships, you know, where in the beginning, right, things seem a little too good to be true, right? It's hard. It's hard not to get swept into that. And I think oftentimes it is abuse is so incremental. Absolutely. And, you know, it's only after, I mean, my first marriage, I mean, I just, like every mistake you could make, right? I really tried to hit, all of the bases super hard, like tore it up, right? And I began to realize how essential privacy actually is to successful relationships, which seems a little counterintuitive in terms of fairy tales, right? In terms of sort of like this, the romance that we're sold of you have to be able to give all of yourself right to your other person. You're supposed to live solely for them. You know, they're sort of as you know, completely intertwined as you can be, right? That's sort of like this ideal state of love, you know, but that's actually not a great way to live. And having your partner be able to read your thoughts would not, I don't believe, be very conducive to people ever being able to live anywhere together in any way.
Now, of course, we don't have chips that allow other people to read our thoughts, but we give up so much of our privacy today. So we all, almost all of us, carry around, you know, these devices with us that are GPS enabled. A lot of us are posting on social media, hey, I'm here. This is where I am now. This is where I'm going next. And also, when you're in a relationship with somebody, you can enable their phone to know where your phone is all the time. So while this is science fiction, it's pretty close to reality.
It is pretty close to reality. And I mean, especially I love convenience. Like, I love convenient things. I mainly eat out of vending machines. Like, you know, I'm not a healthy person. And I would totally, if I could implant something where I hate calling on the phone to order pizza, like online orders. I mean, it's incredible to me, right, that I do not have to verbalize anything and a pizza will show up. But if I could put a button in my arm, you know, and the sad thing is, like, I mean this, you know, I really mean this. If I could put a button in my arm that I could press and a pizza would show up, I would do it, right?
And a lot of people would.
Yeah, I mean, I sure would. You know, like, I would put the internet in my head. You know, I mean, there are all of these things that that I know. And that's one of the things that really fascinates me, not only about technology, but also in some ways about unhealthy relationships, right, of which I totally in the past have been in. You know, like, so often, like, we know the arguments against, right? We know the warning signs. You know, we can know these sort of dangers on the horizon, right? But this, like, immediate of feeling good, it can be so seductive to just be taken care of in the moment.
I'm talking with Alyssa Nutting. She is an associate professor of English at Grinnell College. Her second novel is Made for Love. And coming up in just a moment, I'll introduce Benjamin Percy. His latest novel is The Dark Net. Both of these novels take a look at the dark side of modern technology in some very different ways. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about two novels that explore the dark side of the information age. I've been talking with Alyssa Nutting, the author of Made for Love, which is a book that explores relationships and privacy issues and high-tech gadgets. Now joining us is Benjamin Percy. He specializes in thrills and chills. He's a best-selling author and DC Comics writer. His latest book is The Dark Net, which combines primal fear, modern technology, current events, bringing it all together in complete terror. He'll be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore tonight at 7 p.m. in Iowa City. He'll be at Pioneer Bookshop in Grinnell at 6 p.m. on Thursday. He'll also be leading a roundtable discussion as part of the Writers at Grinnell series. Benjamin Percy, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And again, this is a book that I picked up not really knowing what to expect, and I was surprised immediately because I was expecting the dark side of the internet, but you combine it with some of our oldest fears, the occult and the fight against good against evil. Where did this idea of mashing these two things together come from?
Well, if you think about old fairy tales, let's say that came out of the Black Forest of Germany, oftentimes they were in response to what couldn't be understood. So let's say a child was found dead in a meadow. It's an inconceivable thing, and maybe a story would arise from there about a wolf who could speak, a wolf with cunning intentions. Or if a disease ravaged a village, maybe the myth of vampirism might arise from that. And right now, we don't understand how our technology works, despite how heavily we rely on it. You spend most of your day turning your face toward a screen, but you have no idea how your smartphone functions. And all around us, there are these signals streaming through the air. It occurred to me that we're living in a new kind of wilderness, a digital wilderness, and there haven't been that many stories that have wrestled with it. I've found the series Black Mirror to be especially appealing in the way that it has. It's kind of like a digital era Twilight Zone. And I guess you could describe the novel in much the same way.
We're talking to Alyssa about how we so willingly give so much access to the technology in our life and reveal so much of ourselves through the technology. Did you encounter that fear, that concern in your life? Is that what led you to want to explore it in this way?
I did. I five things happened simultaneously in one fateful week that really informed me wanting to write this book. My sister's email account was hacked. My friend's Facebook account was hacked. And my inbox and their feed filled up immediately with spam. My neighbor tried to file his taxes and discovered that somebody else had already done so and collected the refund. I had my credit card information stolen and used by somebody in Spain at a McDonald's to buy a McFish, which you think they would have gone a little crazier.
You think so?
And then my father clicked on the wrong attachment and his laptop froze and a ransomware message popped up. And it said, you have to pay this much money in bitcoins or we will erase everything on your hard drive. And all of this happened, within a few days. It made me recognize just how naked we are online, how vulnerable we are online, and how easily it is to be possessed, essentially. Like every time your computer chugs a little more slowly, every time your phone blips on and off and errs, you wonder, has it already begun? Right.
Well, maybe you wonder. Maybe the rest of us should be wondering that. Well, and you mentioned bitcoins, and we have this sort of separate digital economy that is existing alongside the more traditional economy at the same time, and most of us don't participate in it at all. And your novel takes us deep into that imagined world. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, it's not like you imagined it. But, I mean, there's just so much we don't know about what's going on.
Yeah. And just to give some context to anybody who doesn't know what the dark net is, the dark net is real. It is the basement of the internet. It's the dungeon of the internet, a kind of lawless frontier. And some people are down there for rather innocent reasons. You have college students in your life probably who are on there downloading the latest Game of Thrones season for free or downloading the latest Jay-Z single for free. There's a lot of, piracy that occurs there. But there's also insider trading that occurs there. There's also every disgusting manner of pornography there. There's also Al-Qaeda and ISIS and the neo-Nazis down there. My friend gets his drugs delivered in a hollowed-out peanut butter jar to his doorstep via the darknet. But there are also embattled journalists and bloggers. Like, they're in areas where they'll be persecuted if they don't upload their information anonymously. So there's a lot of stuff going on down there. A lot of it is rather nefarious, and I'm just interested in the idea of, a sort of new gathering place for evil.
Well, and there's enough scary stuff going on the dark net that you know, you could have terrified all of us by just exploring ideas of what might actually be going on there. But you also combined it with black magic. Mm-hmm. So why put those two things together?
Every time that you swipe a screen, every time that you click a mouse, every time you clack a keyboard, it's feeding into an algorithm. And sometimes this is the work of an advertiser. That's why those, you know, commercials pop up on the side of your screen that are targeted directly at you.
Right. They know exactly what kind of T-shirt I want.
Exactly. And where you are and what your gender is and orientation and political stance and everything else. But there are also people watching and they're watching, you know, what you post on Facebook or on Twitter. You know, there's that photo of your family, or there's you checking in at this location, announcing that you're not at home, or whatever. And that, you know, the fact that we're giving up our information so willingly, and the fact that people are taking advantage of that, that are pirating that, it seemed like there's a strong connection to like old tales of possession. And that's how I came up with the idea to merge the two. And I've always been interested in, you know, no matter what the book, like Red Moon is about xenophobia and terrorism, right, even though it's about
werewolves.
Right. You know, the Deadlands was about ecological disaster, even though it was, you know, also about all sorts of this other post-apocalyptic nonsense. And, you know, I'm interested in taking a knife to the nerve of the moment. That's what I was doing right now. We have so many things to fear, but I think cybercrime is chief among them.
Would you read a little bit from the book for us? And I think you might have to put it in context for us a little bit.
You got it. This takes place toward the end of the book, and it's sort of one of those overarching moments where I go into omniscient mode and account for, you know, the threats of the internet. Used to be, to open a door, you rolled aside a stone. Centuries later, you lifted a latch, then you fitted a key, turned a knob. Now, you can open a door with a phone, or a fingerprint, or a voice command. Times change. The ways of entry change. But you still have to open the door. On this October 31st, Samhain, All Saints' Eve, All Hallows' Eve, Halloween, the fall climax, when the division between this world and the other frails, they open the door. For the past few years, Undertown Incorporated has been busy harvesting information. 80 million accounts from Anthem and 70 million from Target, 56 million from Home Depot, 76 million from JPMorgan Chase, Ashley Madison, AOL, British Airways, Living Social, Adobe, UPS, and eBay, and Blizzard, and Domino's, and more. So many more. Amassing information. Every time news broke about a data hack, people panicked, worrying over their credit cards, and bank accounts especially. But when nothing happened, when no mysterious charges appeared, when no one applied for a credit card or a loan in their name, they forgot. They only worried about money, as though money were the only thing worth stealing. But Undertown wanted usernames and passcodes, the more subtle but severely damaging information, because that is the way in. The ciphered connection between your fingertips and keyboard. Jimmy's opened the lock. This is what everyone should be worried about, not their accounts, but their identity. Snowden leaks the NSA files. Hackers leak the Sony emails. Facebook and Google track your browser habits, your buying habits, your location, your race, gender, religion, age, orientation, and custom fit their ads accordingly. DNA has been replaced by streams of data, and it has become dangerously clear how your digital footprint can come back to haunt you with so much of your life online. Just like that, you can be stalked, pirated, erased, possessed.
Benjamin Percy reading from his latest book, The Dark Net. And that is a perfect example of how you terrify your readers. Because every time I found myself thinking, that's a little silly. You know, there aren't hellhounds that are going to come and get me, probably. And then I think, oh, yeah, I remember when Target was hacked. I remember when this information was collected. So those touchstones in reality.
Right. And I spent a lot of time researching this to authenticate it, even though it goes into supernatural territory. I scammed my way into researching this via an article I wrote for GQ. So I lived a tech-centric lifestyle for a whole month. You know, they sent me Google Glass. I had like 5 Fitbits and 3 Apple Watches. I had this SoundHawk technology that allowed me to eavesdrop on somebody across the room. I had Chromecast. I had Apple TV. I had 10 tablets. And then I traveled to the Google campus, and I rode in a driverless car. And I visited, you know, their secret experimentation area, and they made like 5 clones of me that are currently wandering the earth. And, you know, I also spoke to people at Verizon. I also spoke to people at Apple. And even though I was writing this article, I was, you know, making a lot of queries into digital security so that I could make this as realistic as possible.
Having submerged yourself in that kind of technology, the kind of crazy technology that Alyssa was writing about that is almost real, how did that change your day-to-day interaction with technology, coming back to what we like to refer to as the real world?
I become more wary and paranoid than ever. I mean, everybody feels uncomfortable with technology right now. There's not a day that goes by that you don't think about, you know, deleting your social media account because it makes you feel full of self-loathing every time you post something. Everybody wishes they could answer fewer emails. Everybody wonders, like, what effect is this phone having on my brain? Or how about my kid's brain? You know, it's bad enough for those of us who are 30, 40 years old and have been using smartphones for the last 5 years. What if you grow up with that in that age of this age of distractibility? But, you know, there's even more uncomfortable truths at work. Like right now, people are live streaming lives through laptops and through phones without their owners being aware. You can hack onto somebody's computer and then on the dark net, auction off access to that person's life. You know, it's like Big Brother, the TV show, or some version of the real world is happening in so many people's devices right now without them knowing. Which is why, you know, I now have a piece of electrical tape over my laptop camera. Because I wouldn't want people staring at me as I picked my nose and, you know, wrote my goofy novels.
Well, the main character in, well, there are many characters, but one of the main characters in the book is a journalist. And she's a bit of a Luddite. Her friends or coworkers, maybe she doesn't have friends, call her a Luddite and make fun of her for not embracing technology. And so I'm hearing some of that in what you're saying right now, maybe a little bit of an alter ego. Mm-hmm. There's also, I was thinking about you as a dad when I was reading the book, because so many of us are afraid that our children are being hurt by this technology or that we're losing our kids to this technology. And one of the other characters in the book, she's a 12-year-old girl. And she's blind, and there's this amazing technology that can restore her vision, but it also opens her up to this incredible vulnerability because she's basically plugged in.
Mm-hmm.
Was the father, Ben Percy, also expressing his fears about his kids growing up with this technology?
Absolutely. I have a lot in common with the Lila Falcon character, the journalist at the Oregonian. Who's one of the main characters. There are several main characters. There are storylines all thread together. But I went from being rather technophobic to technocentric. You know, like when I first set off to write this book, I was like, I read the Lev Grossman article in Time about Silk Road. I was like, I want to write about the deep web. But, you know, I myself didn't know much about technology. You know, instead of Microsoft Word, I used a stone tablet and a chisel. My smartphone was a tin can with a very long string. So I had to immerse myself in this world just as she does. That also makes for a really good cheat, you know, from a writer's perspective. Like, you always want to feed your information to your audience, but it can come across as really ham-fisted, like an exposition dump if you don't handle it properly. So giving a perspective to a rookie character, like, she doesn't know much about technology, so she has to learn about it with the audience. Just like Harry Potter doesn't know anything about magic and learns about it with the audience as he travels to Hogwarts. And so, yeah, I feel a strong connection with her. I also, you know, she became technocentric. And this book, just to be clear, is not like, you know, technology is bad, okay? You know, that's not like what you take away from the book. Technology is ultimately what saves everyone as well. Now, with the younger character, Hannah, I was actually thinking a lot about my daughter there in that we were at a comic book shop a few years ago, and she came up to me with this sour expression on her face, and I asked her what was wrong, and she said, "We're all the girl heroes." And I was like, "Yeah, you're right. Where are they? This is..." And it's been bugging me ever since. And I was thinking about her, like channeling her into the book as best as I could. Also thinking about Spielberg and the way that oftentimes, or Stephen King, if you look at It, you know, the children are the ones who recognize that, you know, the adults are blind to what's going on. The children are ultimately the ones who have the courage, wherewithal to like overcome the odds. I've always liked that model, so I was playing with it as well.
They also have a clarity, a sense of right and wrong that's not muddied mm-hmm. by life. There's so much in the book that echoes reality. Were you afraid of reality overtaking you at any point in writing it, that maybe this wouldn't feel like science fiction? It wouldn't feel far-fetched?
Everybody always asks me, like, do you scare yourself when you're writing? And the answer is no. I have a callus around my heart the size of a catcher's mitt. But I am definitely thinking about, like, how can I emotionally manipulate my audience best? And, you know, laughing evilly to myself as I write. And one of the things that's been rather scary to see is how some of these things have come true. Like, malware can now be imprinted on your DNA, which means that I am Nostradamus.
Right. And none of us will ever sleep again. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Benjamin Percy, author of The Dark Net, and Alyssa Nutting, author of Made for Love. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're exploring two new novels that take a look at the dark side of the information age. Benjamin Percy is here. His latest book is The Dark Net. He'll be reading tonight at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City at 7 p.m. He'll be at Pioneer Bookshop in Grinnell on Thursday at 6 p.m. He'll also be leading a roundtable discussion as part of the Writers at Grinnell series. And Alyssa Nutting is here. Her second novel is Made for Love, which tells the story of a woman trying to escape an abusive relationship, but she's lost all of her privacy because of high technology innovations that have allowed her husband to implant a chip in her brain. And Alyssa, I just asked Ben if, as he was writing the book, if he was ever afraid that reality would get ahead of him because, you know, he touches reality but then goes further. But every day we wake up and we look at the news and think, oh, I didn't think that could happen. Were you afraid that your high tech, I can't imagine this kind of technology would become real while you were in the publishing process?
I really could imagine, you know, that it would. And I almost kind of feel like it has, you know, that sort of this has been done or tried or, you know, at least attempted, and we just don't know about it. I really tried to kind of write it even just sort of with that in mind, you know, like fully feeling like at some point we will get there, and just sort of the elements of the story need to hold up on their own.
Well, and I would describe your book as satire. And I can imagine that this day and age is a very difficult day and age for people who write satire because, you know, the whole idea is to take reality and then take two steps further so that it's ridiculous, but scary and hilarious. But reality is just always crossing that line these days.
It's yeah, I mean, in some ways it's a great time, right, to write satire, and I really think, you know, that satire is needed more than ever now. I just think you're allowed to say things in satire, you know, just with a directness, right, and a bold truth, just kind of using humor as a shield. I think it just lets you kind of get closer to the flame, you know, of what's really going on, you know, not just satire, but all comedy.
Well, I have a little bit of a weakness for old mysteries. And one of the things that I've noticed is that, I mean, mysteries had to change dramatically because of technology, because there's so much less tension when somebody is always connected. When you're not alone in a terrifying situation, you have your smartphone and you can, you know, call someone or communicate with someone. Does that make writing thrilling fiction? Does that make it more difficult that it's harder to isolate people, Ben?
I think so. I mean, so much of suspense has to do with not knowing, right? And I've even heard jokes about, like, if you take old novels or old movies and, you know, implant smartphones within them, it would just, you know, the books would be over in 15 pages.
Or right.
The movie Home Alone would be over in 5 minutes.
Should have been over in 5 minutes anyway, but personal opinion.
And so technology has made things seemingly impossible at first. I was like, well, how do you write a mystery or how do you write a thriller when you have all this tech and you just have to lean into it and, you know, recognize that the rules have changed and discover other ways to play around with unknowingness. And in this case, you know, giving the most of the story to a character who knows nothing about technology helped,
right.
You know, this Luddite character who is on the fringes of all this tech craziness that's going on. You know, it aligned with my own perspective.
Yeah, and I think also in ways, I mean, there are so many ways that technology also sort of enables not knowing. You know, like, I don't know how to get anywhere, you know, because I use my GPS and maps for everything. And the times when suddenly my cell signal fails, right, or I'm in a strange city driving around in a rental car and my phone's about to die, right, and my charger stops working, you know, that's kind of a different type of terror that that we can experience today, you know, that wasn't experienced in the past.
I have written two stories, one short story now and a screenplay that I'm fiddling with, where the characters go out far enough into the wilderness where everything blinks out. Mm. And I have to say that I find that, you know, to be a great plot move.
Absolutely.
And that all of a sudden all these things that we rely upon like a crutch are not available to us.
Well, yeah, people didn't even carry paper maps in their cars anymore. I think we set ourselves up for that, to walk right into a Benjamin Percy story. I'm scared to go anywhere. I want to talk about your main characters because, again, one of your main characters, Layla, and one of your main characters, Hazel. There's another character that we get to know very, very well throughout the book as well, who's a unique personage also. But they both had a couple of interesting things in common. Now, Layla is much more of the hero type. She's somebody that you want to be like. She's reliable and resourceful, whereas Hazel is pretty defeated by the world, and you don't want to be like Hazel. But they both had a couple things in common. One was a love of comfortable clothing. And I have said on numerous occasions that the best thing about the 21st century so far was the invention of yoga pants. So was there anything really purposeful about these women who just loved to be comfortable? They both wore sensible shoes, too. I loved that. I totally related to that.
Well, just for the listeners out there who can't see us, you know, we're all wearing camo Snuggies right now.
And very sensible shoes.
I do love Snuggies.
But is there, I mean, with your book, is there a taboo to liking to be comfortable that you were trying to break through? Or what? It seemed very purposeful that it did come up because it also took away some of her individuality, the fact that she was getting dressed in high-tech clothing that her husband chose.
Well, I think sort of in you know, kind of mainstream, you know, depictions in society, I don't think that women are encouraged to be comfortable. And when you look at the differences, you know, between kind of the way, you know, that the gendered clothing is sold, right? Very utilitarian things, you know, like pockets. You know, Hazel really wants her wedding dress to have pockets, right? Because pockets are really freaking useful,
yep.
Right? But that's not, you know, usually wedding dresses don't have pockets.
Yeah, pants. Don't even have pockets,
right.
Often when they're sold for women.
And I mean, even, you know, sort of going back to, you know, to the superhero thing, right? I mean, there are just certain outfits that that hinder movement, and there are outfits that make movement easier.
Another thing that you both had in common were characters who were, for all intents and purposes, immortal, or at least very long-lived, who were chain smokers. I thought that was an interesting commonality between the two. Why would you choose that, Ben?
Oh, just the ironic touch, of course. But there's also, you know, just throughout the book, there's more than one character who has a sense of immortality, and it's because of technology. That just that idea right now that everything you're putting online is somehow forever, that it's been, you know, it has a footprint in some data center somewhere. And even if you delete that tweet, right, some troll can find it and bring it back up again.
Or it's stored in the Library of Congress.
Right.
You, Ben, are involved in a number of different worlds. I mean, you mentioned short story writing and you mentioned working on a screenplay. You're also a comic book writer. You've written Green Arrow, Teen Titans. You are working on James Bond too.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about technology. I mean, so many of the James Bond toys have become reality.
Yeah.
Do you have to reach even farther into the future to come up with technical gadgets that he can use?
You know, James Bond oftentimes has a parallelism to what's happening right now. You know, if you look at Dr. No and the Bay of Pigs, there's a strong connection there. There was a Julian Assange-like character in a Bond pick from a few years ago, played by Javier Bardem. And so it was very easy to me, given how much research I'd put into the Darknet, to write this Bond arc and make it all about vulnerable data, and to make it about a villain who was harvesting our data by hacking into various systems and amassing information for political maneuvering, so that he was making, pitting other nations against each other by making them bid for each other's data. So it became this geopolitical situation, like a weapon of mass destruction was information. So
wow.
I was able to just ride the tailwind of the Darknet into this James Bond experience.
But can Q overcome that?
Well, you know, Q's always sort of bumbling in the background. He does give James Bond, of course, some great gadgets. But at the end of the day, it's not just the, you know, data erasure watch that, you know, that destroys all data within 50 yards that helps James Bond win the day. It's also, you know, his fist, because James Bond, as Ian Fleming said, is a weapon.
Something else that the two of you have in common, and we've talked about this on the show in the past, Ben, about writing genre novels, but I mean, they're also literary fiction, and that science fiction, horror, these are genres that don't get the same kind of literary respect as other genres. I mentioned that your book, Alyssa, I mean, it looks like a romance novel. It's biting satire, but it would be easy to think, oh, that's chick lit, and be dismissive of it. Do you struggle with that as a writer and as a person who teaches writing and you know, is a professor of English? Do you struggle with being pigeonholed in a genre?
Genre, I mean, I don't know. Genre fascinates me. What do you think about genre? I think at certain times, you know, I mean, I'm such a believer. You know what I mean? Certainly, as you know, I mean, teaching, right, creative writing, there are different, you know, conventions, right, in different genres, you know, that you're certainly, you know, these rules that you're adhering to, right, and kind of riffing off of and upholding. But then at other times, you know, I mean, it seems, you know, a large part of kind of what you're talking about and referring to, I think, goes to marketing, right? And not so much things, you know, that authors are doing or necessarily
right.
Even readers are doing, right? But things that that are occurring for sales and money.
Yeah, they're, only academics seem to be obsessed with this. You know, they have the AWP conference every year. It's some 10,000 nerds all wearing Warby Parkers and scarves get together in one place. And there's endless panels about this very thing. You know, there's a panel on what does it mean to be a Southern writer? And there's another one on what does it mean to be a country noir writer? And on and on and on and on. And, you know, it doesn't really matter. And there was this.
There was writer, this. I take issue.
There's this sort of like false taxonomy, these phantom barricades at work that, you know, are exclusionary oftentimes in academia where, you know, I had it happen to me over and over again. The professor, you walk into the classroom and you're ready to write some stories about vampires and dragons and barbarians and woolly underpants. And, you know, the professor says no genre. And I was taken aback when I first heard that and asked very earnestly, you know, what else is there? You know, what else is there besides the barbarians with the woolly underpants? And thereafter, I learned I had never read James Baldwin. I'd never read Raymond Carver. I'd never read Flannery O'Connor. I'd never read Alice Munro or Sherman Alexie. And I fell in love with those writers, but I never fell out of love with genre. And I think that the tide is turning right now. If you look at cheerleaders like Michael Chabon and Jonathan Lethem, if you look at, like, how celebrated Margaret Atwood and Kate Atkinson are right now, if you look at the work of Karen Russell, if you look at the work of Kevin Brockmeyer, like, there's a kind of slipstream effect that's seeping into everything where it's neither fish nor fowl, both literary and genre, both artfully told and compulsively readable. And really, I feel like at the end of the day, just a bit of advice to Prairie Lights Bookstore, you know, divide your inventory into two sections, books that suck and books that don't suck.
Well, that's what you talk to the bookseller about. What should I be reading? But do you ever feel, I mean, it seems like you, speaking of genre, I mean, you, your life as a professional, you cross all of these different genres as a best-selling novelist, as a comic books writer, as a man who teaches writers workshops, you know. Does it feel surreal to go from a writer's workshop in the woods to a Comic-Con?
That is oftentimes very jarring. One of the things that's jarring about it, too, is, well, a few things. One, the way that fans react. Like, you do a literary event, and everybody's like, oh, yes, that's very interesting. And they, you know, softly applaud and maybe say something. Would it inconvenience you to sign this copy of a book? And then, you know, you go to a comics convention, and, like, everybody's dressed up like your character. They're like, I love you. Sign everything. Sign these comic books. Sign my back. You know, tattoo your name across my eyelids. And then, you know, you sit on a panel and you go to AWP and, like, everybody's taking notes, you know, very seriously. And, yeah, you know, any sort of literary convention, people are you know, they might be live tweeting some sarcastic hashtags or something. And then you go to a comics convention. There's 2,000 people at the panel.
Wow.
And half of them are wearing Chewbacca t-shirts. And if you say, I had to figure out how to talk in front of these crowds because I was still doing the literary thing. And I was like, well, if you look at the influences that, you know, inform my work. And that was not going over well. And then I figured out, oh, I'm actually supposed to be talking like Macho Man Randy Savage. That's how I'm supposed to talk to the convention crowd. So I'm like, and then Green Arrow and Black Canary, they're going to kick some butt. And, you know, everybody, like 2,000 people are on their feet in Chewbacca t-shirts going, yes.
But like, they're real readers.
There's some
readers.
Code shifting, I mean, that
I
goes
think,
on.
Right. But definitely, you know, they're real readers. They're incredibly enthusiastic readers.
Like, fan is short for fanatic.
Right.
And the thing that goes along with that, though, is, like, they are on you. If you screw up, right, if you betray their character, because they love these characters. And if you do something that feels like, if you put the wrong piece of dialogue in Damian Wayne's mouth, you know, Robin's mouth,
right.
If you make Green Arrow and Black Canary split up, you know, they take out the knives.
and
they're all over Reddit and Twitter. They'll turn on you in a second.
Interesting. Well, fascinating. keep crossing all those barriers and come back and visit us again sometime soon. Benjamin Percy, his latest is The Dark Net. And Alyssa Nutting, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Alyssa Nutting's latest is Made for Love. She is an associate professor of English at Grinnell College. Benjamin Percy is in Iowa briefly. He's going to be at Prairie Lights Bookstore tonight, reading at 7 p.m. He'll be at Pioneer Bookshop in Grinnell at 6 p.m. on Thursday. He'll also be leading a roundtable discussion as part of the Writers at Grinnell series. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.